Deco Retro program here on Planet FM. We will bring you interesting interviews, updates of future deco, modern, retro, and other related events. Also, the stories that celebrate New Zealand's history and its people, as well as book reviews and other snippets capturing the glamour and fascination of a bygone era.
Deco Retro, Deco Retro.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to our first Deco Retro program for 2019. Today you're with Philippa, and our program is about books and bookshops. When I was growing up in the 1950s, there was no television in New Zealand, so books were an integral part of my childhood, and they gave me immense pleasure, especially those with beautiful illustrations. How could anyone ever be lonely when you could be transported to a secret place and immerse yourself in a magical world? Books are powerful. Books fire the imagination and allow you to walk in another's shoes and experience the exhilaration and sadness that is an inevitable part of life. I've kept some of those wonderful books from my childhood, and I treasure them. Stories have been written on many things over the past few thousand years. Stone tablets, ivory, tree bark, palm leaves, parchment, papyrus, and even dried snake skins. But we can thank the Chinese for inventing paper. And we can thank Johann Gutenberg for inventing the first printing press in 1450, enabling literacy to spread to the masses. The oldest bookshop in the world, the Bertrand Bookshop in Lisbon, opened in 1732 and is still trading. Likewise, the oldest bookshop in London, Hatchard's in Piccadilly, founded by John Hatchard in 1797. One enterprising fellow, John Vandenberg Quick, chose an unusual location for his bookshop, 76 feet below high water mark under the Thames in Brunel's Thames Tunnel when it opened in 1843. Nowadays, there are bookshops and barns, caravans, converted railway stations, barges, and in New Zealand, even a disused piggery. The legendary hard-to-find bookshop in Onehunga Mall was opened in 1988. Over the ensuing 30 years, it became a sought-after destination for many Auckland book lovers. To the consternation of its loyal customers, the bookshop was forced to close in June last year. A new home had to be found for the hard-to-find bookshop, and fast. Fortuitously, there was an empty Catholic convent at No. 2 St. Benedict Street in Eden Terrace, and much to everyone's relief, this was offered to the owner to set up shop and relocate all those hard-to-find books. A staggering 90,000 books were duly boxed and moved to the convent, where they are now happily housed in harmonious surroundings. Warwick Jordan, the owner of the hard-to-find bookshop, is here with us today to tell us about his bookshops. Welcome, Warwick.
Pleasure to be here.
First of all, tell us a bit about yourself and how you became involved in selling second-hand books. I'm rather curious about the piggery as well.
The piggery. The piggery actually came along a little later when I was in my empire building stage. I originally got into second-hand books purely by sort of accident, I suppose. I was very keen on handcraft printing and publishing, and I was trying to find a way to make that financially viable, which is pretty much impossible. So I supplemented my income by selling a few of my books. and that snowballed into a bookshop, which then took over everything, and the printing and publishing went by the by, and the bookshop carries on.
Well, I seem to remember you telling me that you started in a garage.
Yes.
And then somewhere, where was that?
88 John Street, Ponsonby.
Ah.
I was renting a house and garage there, flatting with other students and so on, and I was actually working on labouring schemes, I think, at the time. And that's where I sort of started off. The first version of the hard-to-find bookshop was a couple of bookcases in the garage on a Saturday afternoon.
Now, with the piggery, what made you decide to start up one
I bought a property. It was in the days when I actually had some money. bought a property up in Whangarei Heads.
Yes.
Beautiful big piece of sort of native bush. And there was a disused piggery on the property. And I moved up there to live, and I was harassed by friends that I should be sort of having a shop in, up north in sort of Whangarei. So I said, oh, well, all right, then I'll shove some books into the old disused piggery and I'll open for a couple of hours on a Saturday afternoon. And it was about 3 km up a dirt road, sort of out in the middle of nowhere. But after about a year or two, I had to move it into Whangarei itself, simply because so many people turned up there, it was upsetting the neighbours.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
the most unexpected place, you know.
Well, I thought it would put everybody off, and I was quite happy for that to be the case. But it didn't work at all. And that shop's still going. I don't own it anymore. But
it's still going.
It's still going. Oh. I don't think it's in the premises that I had it in. I think that's now moved.
Grown.
Well, I don't know. These things, the whole thing with bookshops, they wax and wane.
Yes. Now, when the hard-to-find bookshop closed in Onehunga, I think you said it was a massive rent rise.
Well, the situation, we'd had a very long-term lease, which was a very favourable lease.
Yes.
Won't go into all the details of all that, but it was a very good lease for us. And it allowed the business to survive, perhaps beyond its use-by date. But the lease expired, and the owner of the building wanted to sell, because the expiry of the lease allowed them to.
Yes.
Because they wanted money, lots of money. And we're stuck with a situation where if a new person bought the building, then we would be out, because there's no way we could pay commercial rents. So I tried to raise money to buy the building ourselves. I didn't have anything myself, and I thought, well, I'll be completely mad and have a go at doing the give a little thing. Thought it was very sort of, I thought I'd get a lot of flack for it, because going out sort of with my little tin cup saying please buy me a building seemed a bit like people would be quite annoyed with me or think it was just ridiculous. But in fact, we ended up raising $27,000 from hundreds and hundreds of people all over the world.
I think you underestimated how important that sort of shop is to people.
I did. I mean, I loved the place, but I didn't realise just how many other people did. And I got all sorts of incredible bits of feedback from people. Generations of families that had come there buying books, because it'd been there 35 years.
Mm.
And, it was quite emotional. Of course, $27,000 won't buy you a building. But what it did buy us was the potential to move, because we just didn't have any funding at all. So it at least gave us sort of a moving fund. But then we were presented with the problem of where to move to. And that, again, was a huge mountain to stride over.
Well, that's an interesting story in itself.
Well, it was getting to desperation stages.
I know. I remember reading an article.
Yeah, we got down to the point where I was sitting with my wife on one occasion saying, you know, we have to look at bankruptcy, basically.
Oh, my God. All those books. Oh.
Yeah, I didn't really quite know how to handle it. I mean, we have altogether, between the shop that was in Onehunga and a shop we have in Dunedin, combined, there's about 500,000 books.
Yeah.
Oh. Probably a little bit more than that. But the whole lot, business it lives on a smell of an oily rag, and the slightest disruption and the whole thing would fall over, basically. It pays everybody's wages and it pays the rent and that's about it.
Now, tell me how you came to find the Catholic convent, how that came about.
I did lots of sort of writing to every institution and famous person I could think of that might be able to come and champion our cause and somehow rescue us, but nothing worked. But I'd always saved in reserve. I'd sort of had this sort of vague hope or faith, I suppose you might call it, that somehow the Catholic Church was going to come to our rescue. I don't know
really?
Why. I don't know
was
where
that a premonition?
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of.
Yeah.
I'd bought books off priests a number of times. I'd bought books from the church at St. Benedict's. They used to have a library downstairs for the monks. And joined up a few different groups, had joined their libraries, and that had become redundant. So I'd bought that back in about 2010 or so.
Hmm.
And so I had lots of really nice dealings with the church, and I found them very sort of supportive of what we were doing. So I'd sort of held in reserve that sort of hope, and I wrote to the Bishop of Auckland, Patrick Dunn, and just said, you know, I'm not actually Catholic myself, but I've been told I need a miracle, and you guys specialise in miracles, so maybe you could find one for me.
Yes.
And he wrote back and said, well, you know, good luck with your situation. But he didn't really think he could help, but he would put it in front of his property managers just in case there was something floating around.
Yeah.
And so at that point, I thought, oh, well, I gave it my shot and that was it. Now what? And then a few weeks later, I got a call or an email from one of the property managers saying yes, they thought they might have a property that would suit. So I came up and had a look.
Mm.
That was on the 7th of December last year. And it turned out to be the absolute perfect place.
Well, it is, isn't it?
Incredibly, incredibly lucky.
I know. Yes, I mean, when Nancy and I visited the shop, we were just overwhelmed by the sheer scale of it.
It was a fairly big exercise to move.
I mean, 90,000 books is mind-boggling.
It's a lot of boxes.
A lot of boxes.
Well, to give you an idea, the money that we raised from the fundraising went purely into buying the timber for the shelving. There's over 2 kilometres of timber.
Really? What sort of timber? Just any pine or?
No, it's called Lawson's Cypress, or Lawson's Pine.
Yes.
And it has a lemony scent to it.
Yes.
Which insects don't like.
Ah.
So the shop smells really nice. It's not strong. It's just, it's there. It's a fresh sort of smell.
Yes.
So, yeah, insects don't like it and customers do, so it works quite well.
Well, now, I read somewhere that books, as they age, smell of vanilla. But I've never noticed it with any books.
Some of the older
got.
Ones, some of the 19th century stuff before they started doing acid-free paper, the paper effectively rots over time. You can minimise that by reducing moisture and so on. But it does get quite a unique sort of a smell to it. I'm not sure if I'd call it vanilla.
No, no.
Probably not quite. I mean, some people love the smell. I like the smell of leather-bound books, but I'm not so sure about rotting paper.
No. And now, do you get, your customers have obviously followed you, I guess.
Most of them.
Most of them.
I mean, there's some that can't, some that didn't for whatever reason.
Yes.
The majority of our customers have stayed very loyal. I mean, that was really, from the Give a Little page onwards, I sort of felt like we had a big support behind us.
Yes, yes. And do you get some interesting, well, I guess, odd bods in that area?
We get everybody.
Everybody.
I mean, we get a really broad range of people. I mean, when we're buying books, I've bought books from people who are selling, you know, their books to pay this week's power bill, through to buying from prime ministers and celebrities. I mean, we meet the full range of New Zealanders.
And what are some of the standout books that you've actually purchased? From
Crikey.
People, or are there so many?
I don't really think in terms of individual books. There have been lots of really standout collections.
Yes.
I'm not all that excited. I mean, it's nice to buy individual books, but I really love buying collections of books.
Yes.
We're by far the biggest buyers of book collections. Most dealers will want to buy a handful of books from the collection and sort of pick the eye teeth out of it, so to speak. The most saleable.
Yes.
I'm more interested in buying really big collections of really interesting books, but they don't have to be the saleable ones. I don't do things in a very sensible business-like fashion.
Well, that's refreshing.
Well, I buy lots of books that they're intrinsically good books and
yes.
they deserve to carry on, and maybe there's no one keen for them right now, but over the next 10 to 20 years, I'm sure someone will come along that will appreciate them. And I buy a lot of books like that. Books that have quite a specialist interest, and the right person will be delighted with them, but an awful lot of people will go straight past them.
Yes.
And they're not the books that a lot of other people might buy for their bookshops, because they're looking, you know, they might have room for a maximum of, most secondhand bookshops are around 20,000 books, maybe 30 tops. And they've got relatively limited space. That's very much what they're conscious of, and they just keep trying to buy the same books that will turn over, and we all know which ones they are, and all the dealers buy the same, those ones.
Yes,
and I want to buy those too, obviously. But we buy a lot of books that aren't necessarily in that category as well.
But they have to be second-hand books, presumably.
A lot of them are in brand new condition.
People have probably read them once and just want to get rid of them.
A lot of people buy them and never read them.
Well,
you get people who collect books for a lot of different
reasons.
I've been
guilty of that, actually.
Yeah. A lot of people get sort of obsessed by a subject and they'll buy all the books on it. Doesn't mean they'll always read them all. People often buy books with the anticipation of reading them and never quite get to it. That happens rather a lot.
People have made dire predictions about the future of physical books. Well, I couldn't imagine a world without libraries and books. How do you see the future?
For a long time, people were raising the issue of e-books with me, and, oh, you know, books are doomed, e-books are going to take over. That's not true, and I think I've never said it. I've always disagreed.
Yes.
And I think my view is actually coming to the fore now, because e-books are on a decline. I'm not saying, I don't know any statistics to back that up, and I could be quite technically wrong, but my overall feeling is that they're in decline, that people aren't as, they were a fad rather than something that's a permanent threat to the printed book. They have their uses. They are great for sort of, you know, enlarging type if you've got vision issues, that sort of thing, good for technical manuals. But most people that I've talked to, they might read a chapter of a book on their e-book, and then they want the real book. They'll go out and buy the real book. It sort of introduces them.
Mm.
But as I often said to people, there's a book by Anthony Powell called Books Do Furnish a Room. Well, e-readers don't.
It's as simple as that. Absolutely, yes.
A big pile of plastic e-readers and you on your shelf is not going to impress anyone.
Well, I must be an odd person because, you know, I've taken a book out of the library, read it, fallen in love with it, and then had to go out and buy it.
Yeah.
Somehow I've had to own it so that I can return to that book.
There are things about books that just don't translate into just a conveyance of technical information. For example, I went to a book buy a few years ago now where I drove a lady whose sister had passed away, and she got me to drive up from Dunedin to Christchurch, which is a 5-hour drive, to come and buy the book collection. And she'd given me some brief idea of what it was, enough to convince me it was worth driving. But when I arrived, she sort of opened the door and she was very sort of hesitant and worried. Oh, I hope I haven't brought you here for nothing. I feel really bad if I have. So I walked into the room where there were several rooms full of books. I walked into the first room and I said, no, I just see a whole lot of old friends in here. And they'd immediately, and it was a great book collection. I was very happy with it, but that's what it felt like to me.
Mm.
You know, it's all the usual suspects, you know, the people you want to see or the books you want. For me, it's the books I want to see, you know, the books that I know, yes, those are really good and will sell quickly. Yes, those are really good and they'll probably never sell, but they're still really good.
Mm. And they do reflect a person's personality.
Very
don't
much.
They?
I get to know
people.
I mean, I deal a lot with deceased estates and I get to know that person pretty well. They're sort of, you know, what they were interested in, what they weren't interested in, the sort of angles and ways they, even down to how they looked after their books, whether or not they wrote in them, all sorts of things that sort of give a little reading of their character. And I really enjoy that.
Well, I know I've, you know, I used to haunt fairs and church, you know, church fairs and things like that, places like that. And I've bought some amazing books. And I like the fact that they've been inscribed. Mm. To Norma on your dali da, you know.
Oh, I love
1928
that.
Or something. Yep. You know, I like that. I like that.
I've got a wonderful one, which is a book from the 1920s, and inscribed in the front, it says something like, to Bob, whatever his name is, an appreciation for you saving our son from drowning at the pools.
They
gave this guy a book, which I think was kind of cool. I like that.
That is. Now, on your travels, I presume you visited some of the well-known book towns around the world.
Yeah.
Have you been to Heianwai?
I've been to Heianwai several times.
Yeah.
I've been there for they have a literary festival, which is great fun. I had lunch with Martin Amis.
Oh.
Had chats with Harold Pinter.
Oh. Really?
And Dame Antonia Fraser, who was...
Oh.
I did a classic... what you call a provincial colonial mistake. I had a copy of The Birthday Party, a first edition of The Birthday Party,
yes,
by Harold Pinter.
Yeah.
And I met Dame Antonia Fraser. And I was going to see Harold Pinter later, but I wasn't sure whether he can be quite cranky.
That wouldn't surprise me.
So when I saw Dame Antonia, I said, you know, I'm going to be meeting Harold Pinter a bit later, and I'm really keen to get this book signed, but I've been told he can be a bit cranky. Could I give it to you? Because they were married.
Yeah.
Can I give it to you and perhaps you could arrange for him to sign it and send it back to me? And she said, of course, darling, I'd be delighted to.
Yes.
And, which is really nice of her. And she was lovely, and you know, that was great. And then about an hour after that, I discovered that they'd just split up in a really nasty divorce where he'd run off with her best friend.
Oh.
I was like, oh, God, I've completely put my foot in it and I'm never going to see that book again. But it did turn up.
Oh.
Duly signed and everything from Harold. So.
Isn't that interesting?
And at the time when I did get to meet him, he actually signed a different book for me. He actually turned out to be really friendly. We got on really well.
Yes. Martin
Amis, yes.
Yeah, would he be a bit kind of,
He was he was quite pleasant.
I think of his father.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, he would be daunting too, you know.
But the embarrassing part about that, I spent most of that lunch talking to his wife, Isabel of Fonseca.
Yeah.
Except that I thought she was just Mrs. Martin Amis. I didn't realise she was an author in her own right.
Oh.
So I was just chatting away to her about various things we were jointly interested in. I've got a thing about John Ruskin and where he used to live in Brantwood and so on. And so we're talking about that. And it wasn't until afterwards I discovered that she wasn't Isabella Amis, she was Isabella Fonseca, and she'd written several books that I was really keen on. And I would have loved to have talked to her about them, but I had no idea that that was her. So.
I know, but...
completely oblivious.
It's such an interesting world opens up in your situation.
Yeah, in those book festivals, it's like going along and meeting sort of rock stars.
Yeah,
except you can go and sit and have lunch with them because there's none of that sort of security issues.
They're
just delighted to chat to people, most of them.
Yeah.
I met Redmond O'Hanlon, who is a famous sort of travel writer, explorer, who invited me to... I've actually got a copy of his book with an invitation to join him on his next expedition. He wanted he and I to go off on an expedition to New Guinea. There's no way I'd go with him because everybody he's ever written a book with has ended up walking out on him in furious.
It's all warned us for that instance. Now, does New Zealand have a book town?
Well, it doesn't have an official book town that I'm aware of, but Dunedin is the city of literature.
Mm.
And I was down there when that happened and was sort of supportive of it. And I think Dunedin is probably the best example of a book town. I mean, it's got so much literary connection, it's incredible.
And I should mention that you also own a hard-to-find bookshop in Dunedin.
Yes. Well, I had the internet business. We were online on the internet since 1997. And that got moved down to Dunedin in 2013, pretty much economic reasons. It wasn't viable to keep it in Auckland. It was way too much floor space for unaffordable rents.
Mm.
But we managed to find a place and a really good landlord down in Dunedin. He's very tolerant of me, I have to say.
Is it in a character building?
It is a character building.
Yeah.
We are actually in the original Hallensteins building, the very first Hallensteins building in New Zealand. Well, that's us.
Wow.
We've got about three floors of it. It's a four-story building. Bottom floor is Milford Art Galleries, and then the rest of it's us.
Well, when I go down to Dunedin in March, I'll make a point of going there.
I think you'd like it.
Yes, I'm sure I would. Well, when Nancy and I visited your bookshop recently, we just felt, as we said earlier, those books are in the perfect place. And we were quite overwhelmed, really, with the stock. And I think I could easily get lost, particularly in the chapel with all those corridors of books.
We do have a map.
We actually
give people a map because it is a bit, people get a bit lost in it. It's quite different from the shop we had in Onehunga.
Yes.
The Onehunga shop was sort of very, very quirky and was sort of built when I was in my 20s and or young, early 20s, and it sort of was very handmade and rough, is how I'd describe it. And it had a certain charm because of that, whereas the shop we have now at St. Benedict Street is much more, it's a class act. That's how I see it. It's really stylish, I mean, I think so.
It is. You've got three very dedicated staff. And
great staff.
He's been with you, the manager, 30 years.
Yep. She started working for me when she was 16.
Okay.
And she's 1988. You work it out.
All right.
I'm not going to say her age. I'll get in trouble.
Brendan's been with you 5 years and Blaze has been with you 10 years.
Yep.
So it's terrific.
We tend to have staff that last a long time, and that's how we've been successful in, aside from choosing good books, I guess, and having great customers, having great staff, really good people who know what they're about.
Warwick, thank you for joining us today. I think we're going to be running out of time if we're going to play a little bit of music.
Oh, absolutely. Have to have the music.
I know you want Puff the Magic Dragon.
Yep, great song.
And I'm just going to say, just a little reminder, that the Auckland Hard to Find Bookshop is now at number 2 St. Benedict Street, Eden Terrace, and the Dunedin Hard to Find Bookshop is at 20 Dowling Street, just off the Octagon. And if you want to find out more, go to www.hardtofind.co.nz. And do go along in the break and have a browse, and I'm sure you'll find something special that's just waiting for you to buy it.
Autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Little Jackie Paper loved that rascal Puff and brought him strings and sealing wax and other fancy stuff. Oh, Puff the Magic Dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. The Magic Dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Together they would travel on a boat with billowed sail. Jackie kept a lookout perched on Puff's gigantic tail. Noble kings and princes would bow whenever they came. Pirate ships would lower their flags when Puff roared out his name. Oh, Puff the Magic Dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Puff the Magic Dragon in a land called Honolulu. A dragon lives forever, but not so little boys. Painted wings and giant's rings make way for other toys. One grey night it happened, Jackie Paper came no more. And Puff that mighty dragon, he ceased his fearless roar. His head was bent in sorrow, green scales fell like rain. Puff no longer went to play along the cherry lane without his lifelong friend.
If you enjoyed our program today, listen every second Wednesday of the month at 2:10 p.m. or download us anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/decoretro. And we would like to thank our sponsors, Club Moderne, Art Deco Society Auckland. We will keep you informed of all future exciting and glamorous events to be held by Club Moderne. For more information, email judith.moore650@gmail.com. That's judith.moore650@gmail.com. Bye for now.